We're holding on page Chof Dalid in Sanhedrin, the second line, middle of Ois Nun. We were learning yesterday that the Gemara had said that from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu until Rebbe, we don't find total Gdula B'Mokom Echad. We don't find one single person who was the greatest person in his generation in Torah, and also at the same time the greatest in leadership and political power and everything over the Jewish people. We have Moshe Rabbeinu, and then after that, the next one who's like that is Rebbe. The Gemara had gone through a bunch of possible candidates that also, and the Gemara said each one of them doesn't work for one reason or another. Each of them did have an equal in Torah or in leadership during his lifetime, during his tenure of leadership, or if not the whole thing, then at least part of it. It's interesting, by the way. I was wondering about the last one the Gemara brings before Rebbe. The Gemara tries Ezra, and the answer was together with him, there was Nehemiah ben Fahalia, who was the same caliber. I was wondering, and why I was wondering to myself, why doesn't the Gemara bring, for example, Shimon HaTzadik? He was the leader, he was the undisputed leader of the Jewish people in his times. Why don't we say that he had total Gula Makam Echad? The only thing I can think of, maybe offhand, is since we know from Pirkei Avos, he was Mishiore Knesset HaGdolah, he was the last surviving, one of the last surviving members of the Amshei Knesset HaGdolah. Maybe at least for part of his time as Kohen Gadol, as leader of the Jewish people, there were other members, there were other still surviving members of Amshei Knesset HaGdolah who are of his caliber, and therefore you can't say that he had exclusively Torah Gula Makam Echad. But it's interesting that the Gemara doesn't even bring up the point. After him, and you have Antigonus or Shsechai, I don't know what the answer would be with him. After that, you have the Zugos, you have Yosef ben Yezer and Yosef ben Yochanan, and Yosher ben Prachya and Mitzah HaBeili. They obviously, we can't say that either of them had Torah Gula Makam Echad precisely because they have their Ben Zug. Maybe it's interesting in that connection. I don't know that we find anywhere the name of Rebbe's Av Beis Din, if he even had one. So that also factors into this. I don't know. Okay. Anyway, we found page Chof Dalet in Sanhedrin. So the Gemara continues. Amar Rav Ada Ba'ava, Af Ani Oimer. So now, before we had Chachamim, Uliu Chachamim, Rabba, the son of Rabba, or Rav Hillel Breid Rav Valas. Rabba Breid Rabba is the son of Rabba, the great Amora. Rav Hillel Breid Rav Valas was a Tanner who lived in the time of Rebbe. We find a few stories here and there in Gemaras and Midrashim with him and Rebbe together. So now, they had said that from Moshe until Rebbe, we don't find Torah of Gula Makam Echad. Amr Rav Ada Ba'ava, so now Rav Ada Ba'ava says, Af Ani Omer, I can say, here's another facet of this. Mimos Rebbe Ad Rav Ashi, Lo Matzinu Torah Gula Makam Echad. From Rebbe until Rav Ashi, you also don't find Torah Gula Makam Echad. In all the generations, from Rebbe onward, you also had, there were enormous Tamar Chachamim, but you never had any one of them as the undisputed leader of the Jewish people, like Rebbe was until Rav Ashi. So you want to ask for Lo, you're telling me not, for Ha'ava Huna Bar Nosson. What about, in Rav Ashi's times, there was Huna Bar Nosson. He was a great Talmud Chacham, we find him mentioned in a lot of places in Shas, and he was also very close with the government. Tosfos refers to a story in Zvachim where Huna Bar Nosson says that one time he was standing in front of the king at an audience, and he would wear a special belt. The Goyim explained that Huna Bar Nosson was not Sam close to the government. He was actually the Reish Felusti. He was the governor of the Jews in Bavel in his times, and he's a royal appointee of that. So therefore, occasionally he would have to appear in front of the king on state business. And then the Goyim explained, based on various Gemaras, and apparently this is how it still was in their times, that the Reish Felusa would wear a certain kind of fancy belt as his, like, his official insignia of office when he comes in front of the king. So the Gemara in Zvachim tells us that one time Huna Bar Nosson was wearing that belt a little too high up, not close to his waist, and the king himself, Izgadir Malka, the Gemara calls him, reached over and put it down and put it in its proper place. He said, you Jews are Dachmam Lachas Koinim B'Goy Kaddish, and you have to look the part, you have to dress in a proper way, the way the Koinim wear. And Rav Huna Bar Nosson says, when I came and told this over to my Rebbe Amemar, he said, you literally were able to see in yourself the fulfillment of the pasuk V'hoi Malachim Oim Nayich, that kings will be your nursemaids. The king himself was kind of like your nursemaid and dressing you properly. Anyway, the point is, so this Huna Bar Nosson, then, is a great Talmid Chacham and Makor of Malchus. So how can you say, then, that Rav Ashi has exclusive Torah Gula Makom Echad? And the answer is, on the contrary, Huna Bar Nosson, Mekav Habakayif Le Rav Ashi, he was subjugated to Rav Ashi. In other words, as great as he was in political power and connections with the government, and also a great Talmid Chacham, he knew that Rav Ashi is greater than him, and he accepted Rav Ashi as his Rebbe and his Rosh Hashiva. In fact, there's a Gemara in Moed Katan where Rav Ashi, towards the end of his life, meets up with the Malcham Avis, and then you know it's your time, and Rav Ashi says to him, basically, what's the hurry? Why can't I have a little more time? And the Malcham Avis tells him no, because now it's time for Huna Bar Nosson to be independent of you. And in Malchus Negas Lachavata, one leadership can't overlap the other by even a hair's breadth. So when it's time, it's time. So we see, in other words, but until then, Rav Huna Bar Nosson was kind of living in Rav Ashi's shadow. So therefore, you can say that Rav Ashi himself had Toro Gdulav Makom Echad. By the way, I mean, Rav Ashi was the Rosh Yeshiva in Surah at the time, in Mosul Mahasi, actually, was where the Yeshiva was located. There was also the great Yeshiva of Pumbedissa. But we see, Rav Shura Goin mentions it in his letter on Jewish history. He explains that in that period, the Rosh Yeshiva of Pumbedissa also were considered like secondary to Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi's Yeshiva was the undisputed great one, and even the Rosh Yeshiva of Pumbedissa considered themselves secondary to and subject to his authority. Even actually, Rav Shura goes on to say, even the Rosh Golusa considered that, like Huna Bar Nosson over here, considered themselves subject to Rav Ashi's authority. For example, he mentions, we find in various places in writings from the times of the Goyim, they would have a special celebration on Shabbos Parshas Noyach or Lech Lecha, I forgot what it was, they'd have a special celebration every year in honor of the Reish Galusa. The Jews above would come to honor their governor, the Reish Galusa, who's descended Ben Achaben from David HaMelech, and every year, I think it was Parshas Lech Lecha, I don't remember, they would have a special celebration in his honor by the Reish Galusa's mansion. But Rav Shura tells us, during Rav Ashi's time as Rosh Hashiva, instead that celebration would be held in Rav Ashi's Beis Medrash. That's how great Rav Ashi was considered compared even over the Rosh Galusa. The point is, in other words, it comes out from this Gemara that there were only three times in Jewish history when we can say that there was exclusive Torah Gdula B'Makom Echad. Moshe Rabbeinu, Rebbe, and Rav Ashi. And appropriately enough, Eitz Yosef points out, each one of them gave us a new facet of Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu brought the Torah to us from Hashem in the first place. Rebbe gave us the Mishnah, which is the core repository of Torah Shebaal Peh. And Rav Ashi gave us the Talmud Bavli, which is also the remaining core of Torah Shebaal Peh. So each one of them had to be done by somebody who had Torah Gdula B'Makom Echad, who therefore has the ability to gather together all the Chachamim of his times and get them to all agree and have them all agree to what he's doing. This way, for example, the Mishnah, the Rambam points out that therefore the Mishnah became undisputed authority by all the Chachamim, because all the Chachamim wasn't just Rebbe sitting up in an attic or something and writing the Mishnah. He had all the Chachamim of that time in his Beis Medrash, and they're all debating it and hashing it out and everything and coming up with what should be the actual Mishnah. And similarly, Rav Ashi and Ravina and Rav Ashi with the Gemara, and therefore each of them is undisputed and becomes, that's it. This is the bottom line as far as Torah Shebaal Peh for all future generations. Okay. In fact, another point that's worth mentioning in this regard also, without getting too far off topic, we also see Koda Adurus Merosh, the Eivishter plans everything in history from afar. After Rebbe's time, in Rebbe's times, there was Antoninus, was the Roman emperor, and he and Rebbe were good friends, so therefore there was peace in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore Rebbe and the Chachamim had the ability to write to compose the Mishnah. After that, then things got much more difficult for the Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael. If Hashem hadn't placed Rebbe there, and Antoninus at exactly the right time, the Mishnah couldn't have been written and it couldn't have been done any later. And similarly with Rav Ashi in Bavel, shortly after his times, there began Xeris and persecutions and wars of all kinds in Bavel that prevented the Chachamim from being able to learn and teach properly, which is why the period of the Amoraim ended, and later on the Rabban and Sivaroi lived in very difficult times. So Hashem arranges precisely everything in its proper time when the Jewish people need it to take them into the next stage of Golos, and eventually to bring us to the Gula Amidus Vashlema. Okay, the Gemara continues. Pisca, another quotation from the Mishnah. One of the differences between Dinim Mominus and Dinim Nefoshes, we said before that Dinim Mominus, you begin from the head of the Beis Din, you begin from the Av Beis Din, and then you work, he says what his opinion is, and then each of the other Dayonim also says their opinion. On the other hand, Dinim Nefoshes, Maskilim Natsad, when it comes to Dinim Nefoshes though, then they have to start from the side, they have to start from the junior Dayonim and work their way up. So the Gemara says, Minohani Mili, where do we know that from? Omer of Achaba Papa, Omer of Achaba Papa, Omer Kro, because the Pasuk says, Loisane al Riv. The Pasuk says, do not speak up on an argument. Now, there's many different explanations of the pasuk in Parashat Mishpatim. Rashi brings over there like three or four explanations of what the pasuk means, but one of the meanings is, loisana al riv, we darshin, because the word riv is written without the yud, we can darshin loisana al rav. Don't speak up against the rav. So in other words, if the rav, if the head of the Beis Din has said his opinion, then you shouldn't be arguing against him. You shouldn't be arguing against the head of the Beis Din. Rashi says, Rashi uses the expression muflashal Beis Din, the Gemara, in a number of places. In Or Masechta and some other places, uses the term mufla for the head of the Beis Din. So therefore, we don't want to begin with him. Rashi points out, what if he decides that the guy is guilty? Now, the other dayanim are not going to be able to argue with him, because, or at least they're not going to want to argue with him. So therefore, we should start from the edges, from the sides, from the junior dayanim, this way. So this way, each one can vote independently, and this way none of them is just following the other one who's greater than him. Tosfos says that, okay, fine. I mean, that when we say loisana al riv, so first of all, then should not apply to dinim mominis as well. Tosfos says, no, by dinim mominis, we're not so concerned like that. It is true also that they can ask abderach shela. They can't say blatantly, maybe, they can't say that you, the av basin, said this, but I hold differently, but they certainly could ask it as a question. Why are you saying this? On the face of it, shouldn't it be like that? Tosva says maybe that pasuk is actually referring only to dinin nefashis and in fact not to dinin mominus at all. Okay, in any case, there's a source why we say that by dinin nefashis we don't begin with the av beis din or the muflash of the beis din. Instead, we start from the side, from the lesser dayanim, and work our way up. Rabbi Baba Chana, Amar Rabbi Yechon and Mehocha. We have a different pasuk which also expresses this idea that when it comes to dinin nefashis, we have to start the voting with the junior members, and the av beis din will give his opinion last. You have in Sefer Shmuel, you have the story of Novel HaKarmeli. The gist of the story is this Novel was a very, very rich guy. At one point, when David and his men are on the run from Shaul, they were in an area where Novel has all his cattle and livestock and everything, and David and his men were helping those shepherds for a period of time there. There were bandits, they were helping them, they were guarding them from them, wild animals, etc., and in general, they were helping out Novel's shepherds. So now comes the time when Novel, when the sheep are going to be shorn, and they would always make a big party in honor of that. It's also, Rashi explains over there, based on Midrashim, it was also shortly before Rosh Hashanah, and David and his men needed food for the Yomtiv. So David sends 10 of his men to go ask Novel, listen, we've been helping your shepherds all summer, and it's also coming Yomtiv, can you give us some food? And Novel answers in a very chutzpahdik way that I'm not going to give any of my food to strangers that came from who knows where, and who is this guy anyway? He's an upstart, he's a nothing. So David considered that merida b'malchus. David had already been anointed by Shmuel as king before that, so he held in that case that I'm the king, and for Novel to disobey and to talk in such a chutzpahdik way marks him as a merida b'malchus. So the pasuk says, "Vayomer David la'anoshav." David said to his men, "Chigu ishes charboy. Each of you strap on your sword." Vayachim, because we're going to go and fight, and then we're going to go and wipe out Novel and his family. Vayachgu ishes charboy, and each of them strapped on his sword. Vayachgu gam David es charboy, and David also strapped on his sword. In other words, we're talking about that when he says strap on your swords. In other words, basically what he's saying is, each of you, if you vote that this Novel is guilty and is a murderer of Malchus, then show that by you're going to put on your swords and get ready. As soon as we take the vote, we're going to go and fight. We're going to go and fight and kill him and his whole household. And we see that David put on his sword last, showing that first they started with the junior members of the Beis Din, and then they worked their way up to David, who was the Av Beis Din. Why the household? I mean, the Mashtus, because they were, David figured, they're probably complicit in it as well. The upshot, by the way, was that Abigail, Novel's wife, was a tzaddikah. She heard what had happened. She quickly gathered together a bunch of food to bring to David, and she goes and brings it to David, and she gives him a whole speech about why you shouldn't do this. You shouldn't, even lahalocha, you're not legitimately the king yet because the people haven't accepted you. Your coins don't circulate among the people. And she explains to him, anyway, you don't want to start off, that your kingship is going to start off with bloodshed like that. And she gives him a whole long speech over about 10 psukim explaining why this would be a bad idea, and don't worry, the Eidusha will deal with Novel and you don't have to, and then David accepts her argument. Tosis points out, by the way, that now the implication over here is that even though David held that he's a murderer of Malchus, nevertheless he would actually have to judge and sentence him in Beis Din before they could carry out the verdict. Tosfos points out that similarly by Uriah Hachiti, the whole story of Uriah and Bathsheba, many years later, we also find the Gemara says that he should have judged him in Sanhedrin. Now, on the other hand, there's other Gemaras that imply that a Mori B'Malchus does not need to be judged. So what is it? Do we need to judge him or not? So Tosfos mentions, first of all, what it may mean. Sure, you have to have some kind of judgment. The king can't just decide unilaterally on his own that the guy is a Mori B'Malchus. All it means is you don't need all the regular rules of Dinei Nefoshes. You don't need what we're saying, for example, we said before that it can only be done by day. It could be done by night as well. And a variety of other things. So here, technically, they might not have needed to start Minachsad. Technically, they might have been able to start. They might have been able to start with David. But fine, David wanted them to start by the side. So that's one possibility. It means you do have to judge him. You do, after all, you need to have Eidos to know whether he's a Mori B'Malchus. In this case, David had his men came and told him what Novel had said. But nevertheless, it still just means you don't need all the regular rules of judgment of a regular Sanhedrin in order to convict a person of being a Mori B'Malchus. Next, Pisgah, another quotation from the Mishnah. Another difference between Dinei Mominus and Dinei Nefoshes is that there are more kinds of people who are qualified to judge Dinei Mominus than Dinei Nefoshes. There are very strict rules for who can sit on a base din for Dinei Nefoshes. So the Mishnah says, "Ve'enah kosher in modern Dinei Nefoshes." Not everybody is kosher to judge Dinei Nefoshes. In particular, they have to not have a mum. They have to not have any physical mum, and they also need to not have any flaw in their yichus. They can't be mamzerim or other psule yichus or psule kol or whatever. So the Gemara says, my time, or why is that? The Tony of Yosef. Rabbi Yosef taught a braisa. Kishem she based in menukin betzedek. Just as Dastin has to be clean, as far as Tzedek, they have to be completely righteous. They can't be biased in any direction. They have to be all the qualities that Yisrei says to Moshe, you have to have in Dayanim, etc. So just as they're clean in that, Kach Menukim, they call Mum, the same way they have to be clean and free of any Mum. And that means a Mum in their lineage, and it also means a Mum in their body. Primarily, we're talking about a Mum in their lineage, but it is true that they also have to be free of a Mum in their body. Where's a pasuk that expresses that? The pasuk says, "Kulach yofer rayosi." Hashem says to the Jewish people, "You, my beloved, are all beautiful." Umum ein bach, and there's no flaw in you. Now, it can't mean the Jewish people collectively. Unfortunately, there are Jews who are flawed in one way or another. So it has to mean specifically the Beis Din, which stands in on behalf of the whole Jewish people. We've talked about before, I mentioned before in this shiur, an interesting vort from Rabbi Yitzchak with his father that talks about a deeper idea behind them. The Zohar talks about a deeper idea in it, and Rabbi Yitzchak expands on it. That among the names of Hashem, there are the names of Hashem that come from the Pesukim by Yisa, by Yovei, by Yates, and Parshas B'Shalach, the last one of those 72 names is Mum, Mem Vov Mem. And since that's 72 names, but there are 71 members of the Sanhedrin, so therefore, in effect, among the 71, there's no Mum, because Mum only comes as number 72. And Mum also is Gematria Lekim, which they're based in themselves, as we talked about before, is called the Lekim, and Hashem joins with them when the based in is sitting, and Lekim Nitza Badas Kale, so therefore, like the Mum that's there is, so to speak, Hashem himself coming and joining them, but they themselves don't have that. No, Mum, Mem Vav Mem is 86. But it's the 72nd name in that sequence. So what it is you take the three psukim by Yisa, by Yovah, by Yeh, the Zohar mentions it, there's actually a Rashi in the Sefer Sukkah that mentions it. You take those three psukim each have 72 letters. You take the first pasuk in order, by Yisa, Malacha, Rekim, Ahoylech, etc. You take the second pasuk and put the letters in backwards order. And then you take a third pasuk and put them in forwards order again. Then if you put them one on top of the other, you have each of them is 72 letters, so you have 72 three-letter combinations. The first one, for example, is you have the vav of Vayisa, you have the hey of the word haloila, the last letter of the second pasuk, and the vav of the third one, Vayet Moshe, and you have vav hey vav, which is the first of those 72 names. And then you go in sequence and you go through all the 72. Rashi mentions it in Masechta Sukkah, for example, when we say, one meaning of it, Rashi says, is that there were mentioned, what's Anivahu, is two of those 72 names. Ani is the 37th one, and Vahu is the first one. And there's a number of other places where they come up, So here we're saying that the Sanhedrin cannot have a Mum. Again, primarily we're focusing on Mumim of Yichus. So the pasuk says that Sanhedrin doesn't have a mum. So Rabbi Levick explains, based on the Zohar, that what it means is because there are 71 members of the Sanhedrin. Of those 72 names, none of them are the sequence mem vav mem. Which one is the 72nd sequence? Well, there aren't 72 members of the Beis Din. So the Gemara says the Dilma Mum Mamish. Maybe it means that they can't have an actual physical mum. So now that happens to be true. It is true that the members of a Beis Din can't have a physical mum either. But that's not what the pasuk is focusing on, and that's not what we're focusing on in the Mishnah. The answer is Amar of Achaba Yaakov Amar Kra. But the pasuk said, because we know that, because the pasuk says when in next week's parasha in Bahaloisa, when Moshe has to appoint new zkenim, Hashem tells him these yaks will shum imach. They should stand there in front of the Mishkan together with you. And what's this word imach? Imach means bedoyin law. They have to be similar to you. You, Moshe Rabbeinu, are of impeccable yichus. There's no flaw in your yichus. Therefore, they also have to be. So Gemara says the Dilma Hasan is from Shchina. That's not a proof. Maybe over there. You know why they need to be? Menukin Mekomor, because the Shchina is going to be resting on them. The spirit of Nevuah, of Moshe, is going to be going on all those 70s Canaan. So therefore, they have to be more qualified than the average Dayanim. So Ella, Omer of Nachman Yitzchak, Omer Kruah, fine, but you have earlier when Yisrael tells Moshe to appoint judges, he says, V'nosu Itcha, they should bear it together with you. And again, Itcha means B'domin L'chol Levi, they have to be similar to you. And you, Moshe Rabbeinu, have perfect Yichus, therefore they also have to be of perfect Yichus. So therefore, this is what we mean when the Mishnah is saying that, for example, Mamzerim and other psulei kohol can be kosher to judge dinin mamonis, but not dinin nefashis. For dinin nefashis, you have to have that to be a perfect yichus. No mamzerim, no geirim, etc. Okay, but it is true, you know, the Gemara has, even though we're not focusing on it over here, it is true that they also have to be free of physical mumin. A couple of interesting things that come out of that. For example, later in the Masechta, we're going to have the famous stories of Gvia ben Psisa representing the Jews in arguments against the Mitzvim and the Knanim and the Yishmaelim about the ownership of Eretz Yisrael. And in each of those things, he presents himself as a Hedyot, as a commoner, not a member of the Sanhedrin. Well, with his qualities, why is he not a member of the Sanhedrin? So one answer that's given is because the Gemara says that he's a hunchback. And therefore, so that's a mum, and therefore he's disqualified from serving on the Sanhedrin. And so there's an interesting tshuva from a Moshe about the question if a person, for example, has something internal, like for example, a pacemaker put in, is that considered a mum that would disqualify someone from serving on the Sanhedrin? It's a tshuva that a Moshe wrote to his son-in-law, Tendler, Olav HaShalom. And the background for it is that Ramosha later in life himself had to have such a thing put in, that he knew that if the Sanhedrin is reestablished in his times, he's no question going to be called as a member of it. So then the question becomes, is that considered a mum? Or not. I don't remember. I think he discusses that because it's internal, it's not considered a mum, but actually I don't remember what the maskana is. Basically the same mum as by Kohen, yeah. Okay. Onward. The Mishnah says that when the Sanhedrin would sit, they would sit kachatsi gurin agula. They would sit in a semicircle. Gurin agula, gurin is a threshing floor. You put the sheaves of wheat on the ground, and you go round and round on them with animals or a threshing sledge or whatever to thresh them. So therefore, a threshing floor would typically be round. Kachatzi gurin agula is half of that, a semicircle. So the members of the Sanhedrin would sit in a semicircle. So as a practical matter, the point is, the Mishnah says this way, they can all see one another. If they sit in a straight line, for example, the guys on the end won't be able to see each other. Mefarshim point out, on the other hand, you don't want them to sit in a full circle for a couple of reasons. First of all, then when the Edim or the Baal Edin are standing in front of them, so they're going to be facing, some of them are going to be facing the back of the Dayanim are going to be facing, some of the Dayanim are going to be facing their backs. But another reason is, practically speaking, they have to go in and out. The Baal Edin, the Edim have to go in and out. If you have a circle, then different times the Dayanim are going to have to get up and down, are going to get up and sit down again to allow them through, so therefore they arrange them in a semicircle. Well, so this is all practical matters, but now the Gemara is going to bring a deeper reason why that is. A pasuk says, and again, a pasuk in Shir Hashirim, Shtorerech Agan HaSahar. Hashem says, metaphorically, to the Jewish people, your navel is like a round bowl. Al Yechser HaMozeg, there should never be lacking from it the well-mixed wine. So the metaphor is, in other words, like you have a bowl in which you mix wine and water to have a nice, delicious drink. So he's saying that your navel, your belly button, is like a bowl in which there's constantly a supply of good wine. So let's understand the deeper meaning of that. Shorerech zu Sanhedrin. The word shorerech over here, the navel, refers to the Sanhedrin. Loma nikra shmo shorerech, and why is it called by metaphorically as the navel? She yeshevis v'tibur shel olam, because they sit in the Bes Mikdash, which is the navel, which is the center point of the world. The Gemara mentions in some places that Yisrael was the center of the world, which geographically, more or less, in terms of the known world of those times, Europe, Asia, and Africa, it pretty much is. But it's also different explanations of what that means exactly. Among other, the Maharal says it explains that since Beruchnius, Eretz Yisrael is the highest. If you take a globe and put Eretz and spin it, so you put Eretz Yisrael at the top, everything else is sloping away from it, and therefore Eretz Yisrael can be called higher than all the other places, but also in the middle of all the other places. Anyway, Yerushalayim, it says, in the middle of Eretz Yisrael, and the Beis Mikdash is, so the Beis Mikdash is like the navel, is like the center point from which the whole world came. And the Sanhedrin sits in the Lushka Sagaz, it's in the Beis Mikdash. When it calls it Agan, when it says a basin, so the simple meaning of Agan is a basin, but we're also understanding it means Meloshin Mogin, Shimiginao, Kol Olam Kuloi, there is Chus, their Torah, and the Din that they judge protects the whole world, because the whole world is protected in the Chus of the learning Torah and the proper Din Tzedek that they judge. Hasahar, when you say Hasahar, which literally means round, literally the word Hasahar means the moon. So she doimel sahar, that means they sat in a configuration like a sahar, like the moon. Now the moon, of course, is round, but first of all, Maharsha points out that the fact that it's in the middle of the world means, therefore, so you have the colder places, and then you have the warmer places in the world. When you have the middle, means the climate is the best suited for chokhmah. So therefore, that's the importance of the fact that the Sanhedrin sits in the middle of the world, where the climate is the most average and pleasant, and therefore is conducive to chokhmah.
Crescent
is a gas. So that's right. So it's a Maharsha. So wait. So hold on. Right. So hold on. So Maharsha says, yeah, because again, it protects the world, because the al shloshah dvarim olam oymen al torah val din val emes val shalom. So yeah. Shaydoim of a sahar, right. Maharsha points out the moon we don't usually see full. We usually see the moon as a crescent or a semicircle or something. And that's, again, we're saying that the Sanhedrin would sit in a semicircle. As opposed, that's why the pasuk doesn't compare it to the sun, because the sun is always a full circle. Okay. Now, the pasuk continues, al yachser hamozeg, when it continues, there should never be lacking in it the well-mixed wine. This means, if one of the members of the Sanhedrin needs to leave for his own personal business or whatever, Royan, we have to see whether there are enough other members left. In Yeshchof Gimel Keneged Sanhedrin Ktana, if there are 23 members left, which is the equivalent in size to the Sanhedrin Ktana, so here we're talking about the Sanhedrin Gdola of 71, but if some of them can leave to tend to their personal matters or whatever, as long as you have at least 23 there at all times during the whole time that Beis Din is supposed to be sitting. The Gemara elsewhere mentions that they would sit there basically from the Talmud Shal Shachar until the Talmud Shal Ben Habayim. So if there's 23 left equal to the Sanhedrin Tana, Yotzeh, then he can leave. The Imlav, any Yotzeh, if not, then he can't leave, because there always has to be 23 over there. The point being, in other words, you have 23 is approximately one third of 71. 71 doesn't divide evenly by 3, but it's 71 divided by 3 would be 23 and a fraction. Therefore, what we're saying, if you have wine, in the Gemara's times, wine was usually mixed in the proportion one part wine to two parts water. So therefore, what we can say is, if you have one third of the Sanhedrin, 23 left, the al yachser hamozeg, there should not be lacking the one third, which is necessary for a good mix of wine and water, then they can leave. If there are too few of them, then he can't leave. Now, we're not talking about the Orach HaNer points out, it's not for a Dvar Mitzvah. If they're leaving for a Dvar Mitzvah, earlier in the Masechta, the Gemara mentioned something about the whole Sanhedrin being able to leave for a Dvar Mitzvah. That's different. But here we're talking about where they're leaving for Dvar HaRashus, as Rashi says, for their last supper, for their own personal business or whatever. The point is, Maharsha says, really, when you get down to it, 23 is the fundamental composition of a Beis Din, as the Gemara derives earlier in our Masechta. How we know that? The fact that you have 71 is really because you can have, in principle, even with a small Sanhedrin, you can have a situation where they have a deadlock, where one of them says, Eini Yegea, and the other ones vote 11 to 11, for example, and then we need to add two more Dayanim, and we have to keep on adding more and more, and 71 is the maximum. So in a certain sense, 23 is the core of the Beis Din, and the other 48 are just kind of our second to that, and therefore, in token of that, you always have to have 23 members there in the Lushka Sagozes the whole time that the Sanhedrin is supposed to be in session. Tosfos, in a couple of places in Shas, makes a different interesting point on this. It's not just, first of all, we're saying Hamozik means the proportion, one third to two thirds, but Tosfos points out another way we can look at it from the point of view of Gematria. The word Mozeg, Mem Zayin Gimel, equals 50. So the pasuk is saying, al yachser hamozeg, there should never be lacking 50 members of the Sanhedrin. meaning out of the 71, 50 of them left, there would be only 21, and that's too few. On the other hand, the implication is 49 of them can leave. Now, if 49 of them leave, that's only 22. Won't that be too little? Tosfos points out that's no problem. We anyway know, as the Gemara mentions in various places in Or Masechta, that a Beis Din can never be an even number because they might be deadlocked. So you're automatically going to have to add one anyway. So if it happens that they're left with only 22 Dayanim, fine, they're anyway going to have to take one of the Talmidim and promote him to the bench in order to have a 23rd. So therefore, it's not such a problem if 49 of them leave. So that we can also derive from this word, Al Yachzer HaMozeg, there should never be that 50 of them leave. That's how Tosfos learns it. What? Because the pastor is not. Because 21 is already an odd number. In principle, 20, in principle, a Beis Din can be an odd number, but that's already too few. Then you don't have, you still need to have, that you should be able to have 23 Dayanim over there. So fine, you can have 22 and promote one Talmud, but not more than that. So the pasuk Shorech Hagan Hasar Al Yachzer HaMozeg therefore is hinting to the Sanhedrin and how they sit in a semicircle and that they protect the whole world and they're in the middle of the world and so forth. Next, the Gemara continues. Let's douse in the rest of the pasuk. The pasuk continues, Bitnei Haremas Chitim. Hashem continues metaphorically praising the Jewish people. Your belly, your stomach is like a heap of wheat. So the Gemara explains this also refers to the Sanhedrin. Because wheat is a vital necessity that everybody needs. So therefore, ma'arei maschitim, I call nan and mimena, a heap of wheat. Everybody has enough of it. It's the basic staple of life. Ach Sanhedrin, I call nan and mitame. And the same with the Sanhedrin, everybody enjoys the explanations that they give in Torah, and it's the staple of a yid's life is what the Sanhedrin teaches us. Rashi points out that the Gemara in a number of places compares knowledge of Torah to wheat. Everybody needs the one who has the wheat, and therefore the Sanhedrin is compared particularly to a heap of wheat. There's an explanation, actually, I think the Chidah says this explanation, that the vote is before we were comparing the Sanhedrin to the navel. That's when the Sanhedrin are in their place in the Lishkas HaGozis. Now we're talking about after the Sanhedrin went into Golos, the Esu Golias, Golos the Sanhedrin. So nevertheless, they're still as vital, so now you can't compare them to the navel from which a baby gets its entire nourishment, but nevertheless we can compare them to a heap of wheat, which is also still very fundamental for human life. And the pasuk finishes off suga bashishanim, hedged around with roses. So what does that last phrase mean? Shafilu b'suga shoshishanim l'yifritzu b'hem pirtzis. Even if it, this refers to the Jewish people in general, even if we're fenced in by roses, meaning even we don't need harsh warnings and punishments and all to keep us away from avodas. Even a slight hedge like of roses, we're not going to trample them and we're not going to go and make breaches in them. So in other words, all we need is like a minor reminder or a minor thing like that, and then we'll stay away from avodas, as the Gemara is going to go on to say over here. So in other words, you won't trample the roses, and then you won't trample the roses, and then, and Marsha points out also, Dafka, a hedge of roses in the sense that a regular person might think, yeah, let me pluck the roses because I want to be able to smell them. But no, we keep the hedge remains off limits, and we know not to touch it and to leave it intact. As we're going to talk about it now, as far as Dam Nida, for example. As we find, so in other words, the idea is the Sanhedrin makes zeiros for us and takonis for us, and we observe them even though you don't need a police force or anything to enforce it, just the yid knows this is the mitzvah, this is the way it is, and therefore he stays away from it. As we find that a certain min says to Rav Kahana, Amritu nida shori liyachudi bahadi gamra, you Jews are saying that a nida, that a woman who's nida is allowed to be alone with her husband. How could that be? How could it be? It's like having fire on combings of flax, which are very flammable. The enema have heves, it won't burn them. So in other words, you have a husband has a burning taiva for his wife and she for him. You're telling me that during the time of Nidah, they're off limits to one another. You're telling me they can be in Yichud, they can be in the same bedroom and nothing's going to happen? Amalei, so Rav Kahana said, yeah, a Torah he'idu aleinu. The Torah is testifying on us with this pasuk. Suga b'sheshanim, we're hedged by roses. Shafilu b'suga b'sheshanim, all we need is a slight hedge of roses, lo yifritzu b'hem protis, and we Jews are not going to make breaches in them. We know the Torah puts a nidah off limits to her husband, and that's all that we need. That's all the hachokah we need to not do anything. Now, And Tosfos, in fact, points out the comparison to Shoshanim is very apt. Shoshanim are Shoshanim, roses are red, and therefore it represents damnidus. So in other words, the Tosfos brings from a medrash that a woman will say to her husband, I had a slight flow of blood, I had a slight flow of red blood. Miyad purish, like immediately, almost instinctively, he knows I got to stay away from her then, as much of a taiva as he has. Tosfos does point out, as a matter of halacha, there are details in this. This only applies only once the couple has had relations at least once. And the reason for it, it's called pas v'salo. You know that after all, soon she'll be tahor and they'll be able to have relations with one another again. On the other hand, it is true that if they've never had relations, then taka, we don't say this, which is why you have the halacha. When you have a chuppas nida, why you have to have that the chosin and tala can't be completely alone in the yichud room, the door has to be ajar, and they have to have shomrim stay with them until she's tahor, because there, that's different. But once they've already had relations at least once, then we say suga b'sheshanim, that we can trust the nefesh elikis of a yid to be able to do the right thing and stay away from the avera. There's a vote on this also. In other words, the idea is, so if you see a hedge of roses, what would taka prevent you from trampling it? It's not the thorns, it would be easy enough to get around those. It's because you realize the beauty of it. It's such a beautiful thing, you don't want to harm it. The same way we realize the beauty and the greatness of mitzvahs, and therefore we're not going to want to trample them and ignore them. Now, Maharshal gives a long, interesting explanation over here, that the question is, how is this going to answer the min? Does the min accept such a droshus? So Maharsha explains like this. You look at the psukim over there. The fact is, the whole Shir HaShirim, or much of Shir HaShirim, is the husband praising his wife, and metaphorically Hashem praising us Jewish people. So it really does fit well with the relationship between a husband and wife. So we say, when we start, let's start over with the pasuk Shorerech Hagan HaSahar. We're saying before that it refers to the Sanhedrin. In another sense, it can also refer to a woman's monthly cycle. And again, Hasahar in the sense is like the moon. It's on approximately a monthly cycle. And Bitnei Harei Maschitin refers to the various kinds of bleeding that a woman has from Nida and from birth and so forth. So, and all of this was caused by Chita, because we know one of the opinions what the Eitz Hadas was wheat, and Chava ate from it, and that's what caused all this trouble. So nevertheless, suga b'sheshanim, nevertheless, when there's the time of sheshanim, the time of nida and the time of birth, then we're going to stay away and we're not going to be involved with our wives, because we know the Torah has fenced us in with that hedge of roses, and the chachamim have the xeris on top of that, and that's all we need to stay away from them. So in other words, what Rav Kahana is telling this min is not only based on the word suga b'sheshanim, he's explaining to him, says Maharsha, that the whole context of the pasuk, you should realize this is also talking about Jewish husbands and wives and their relationships to one another. So the min at least believes in Torah Shabbat, I guess, yeah. Okay. So we'll continue tomorrow, Baz Hashem. Or not tomorrow, on Sunday, Baz Hashem. Yeah, wheat doesn't grow on trees nowadays, but the Medrash says, according to that Mandomer, it did grow on trees before the Chetei Tadas, yeah. Yom Yom Mashiach Ugo'ola for Yudbeis Sivan. So now, today was the last day of Tashlumin for Shavuos. Zman Matan Teresenu. And that's why we weren't saying Tachnun these days, as we know the Alter Rebbe says in the Siddur. And that means, even in Chutz La'aretz, even nowadays, we're not saying Tachnun on these Yemei Tashlumin. What does that mean? In other words, that this whole concept, that what's the Yemei Tashlumin? That these were days when a person didn't bring his Olas Re'ir, or Shami Chagiga, on Shavuos itself, then he has, after the Yom Tov, he has six more days to bring them. So at this point, this means, in other words, that this concept exists even when the Beis Mikdash was destroyed, and even when we're living in Chutz La'aretz. Therefore, hurrah from this in a person's avoida, is that a person has, throughout these days, the ability to fill in, to make up for whatever he hadn't done so far, tashlumin, to make up whatever he was missing, for whatever reason, on Yom Matan Torah itself, which Hakol Modim Vatzeres Be'in Lachem, the Gemara tells us in Pesachim, everybody agrees that Shavuos, you have to have a Lachem, it can't just be the whole day you're davening and learning, you have to give time for the gashmius of your body as well, so that means, in other words, you want to bring down everything of Shavuos, L'mata Ma'aseret Tzvachim, to the Guf and its Simcha, and therefore you have during these days an opportunity to make up for anything you missed in that regard on Shavuos itself. The Gashmias and Beruchnias. Okay. We've been talking about the point about taking tzitzis off one beged and putting them on another, which you're allowed to do, and then what happens if the strings are partially torn, etc. Now, on the other hand, the Alter Rebbe goes on to say, if you're not planning to put the strings on another beged, then you're not allowed to take them off the first one, because then you're taking it away from the first beged for nothing. You're taking away that mitzvah. But what happens, for example, if you plan to do something else with the Beged. Let's say, for example, you plan to recut the Beged so it won't have four corners anymore. Or, for example, you want to sell it to a goy. Then you're allowed to take the tzitzis off it, because then the Beged itself is not going to be bar chiyuva. It's not something subject to the mitzvah anymore. So therefore, you're not taking off any mitzvah from it by taking off the tzitzis. For the same reason, also, the author points out in parenthesis, when a person passes away and they wrap them in a talus, they cut off or they remove one of the tzitzis from the corners or a different minhagim. What they do exactly, but one minig is to remove the tzitzis or some of them or all of them from the talus. And again, there's no problem because that talus anymore is not bad chiyuva because the mess is not chayiv in tzitzis anymore. Cut off. I mean, I think what. Loy Gorosh is a factor of why tackle we cut them off, because we don't want to cut them off completely, because we don't want to be Loy Gorosh. We don't want to mock the mess. Ha ha, we have the mitzvah of tzitzis and you don't. So they're different in Hoggy and what you do exactly. I think the most widespread meaning is they sort of fold in one corner. I don't know, I've never been by a Tara to actually watch and to see in person what they do, but I believe the most widespread meaning is that they kind of chuck in one of the corners of the tzitzis rather than cutting it off entirely. But I think there are different in Hoggy about that in different places. Oh, come on, I'm not catching up.